I hope you remember this particular diagram here. Let me remind you of what it shows. It's a map of the next few lectures, of the material that we will cover and how we will cover it. So here on the left, everything is in the Hamiltonian formalism. This is Hamiltonian formalism formulations of theories. Everything on the right here is Lagrangian formalism. The point being that the Hamiltonian formalism is convenient, but not covariant. And this one is not as, the Lagrangian formalism is not quite as convenient because we don't really have an overview of the Hilbert space structure in this formalism, but it's covariant. So we will take the best of both worlds. Remember, we started out with classical Klein-Gordon theory. So the Klein-Gordon wave function just evolving as a number-valued function, not as an operator-valued function. That's first quantization. But what we want, of course, is second quantization. So as we go from above to below, we go from first quantization to second quantization. Right, so the first step we already started, namely, we studied the Legendre transform in quite some detail and also the functional differentiation that's needed for it. And today we will complete that step, go from the Hamiltonian formalism of a classical Klein-Gordon field, so non-quantized Klein-Gordon field, from the Hamiltonian formulation of it to the Lagrangian formulation of it, so that we get to the action principle. It's a completely equivalent formulation, as you will see. And then once we have it in the action formalism, we will find out how to write it fully covariantly. Because the initial step of just going from the Hamiltonian to the Lagrangian formalism doesn't automatically make it look covariant, but we will be very careful about this and then find out how it is becoming covariant. And then at the end of today's lecture, we will go that step and allow curvature, so that we then have the classical Klein-Gordon theory on curved spacetime. So it's a Klein-Gordon field, not yet quantized, it's just number-valued field, a number-valued field, but living on curved spacetime. And once we have that, then in the following lectures, we can do the Legendre transform back to the Hamiltonian formalism. In this step, we will find out what the canonically conjugate field is to phi, because it's no longer phi dot. And once we have that, phi hat and pi hat can be defined, and we end up with the second quantized Klein-Gordon theory on curved spacetime. And then, as I mentioned previously, we will also cover in a lecture how to go from the fully covariant formulation to second quantization with the Feynman path integral. And then we'll see that this is actually equivalent to that, but it looks quite different. All right, so let's start with this step. We go from the Hamiltonian formulation of the Klein-Gordon theory to the Lagrangian formulation of it. Here's how this works. We start with the Hamiltonian function. Remember that the Hamiltonian is fed two different fields, phi and pi, and it may also be dependent on time, but time is just a spectator in this. However, I am writing the time variable here to remind you of an important fact, which is that the Hamiltonian depends on time, but it doesn't depend on space. Why not? Well, because we integrate over d3x, right? The Hamiltonian is the integral d3x of phi of x, d'Alembert plus m squared phi of x. Actually, no, second. It's pi squared of x integrated half, and then we have the term with the Laplacian acting on phi and the mass and so on. But the whole thing is an integral over x, but not over t. We will have to fix this too, because that cannot be covariant. But that's our starting point. The Hamiltonian depends on phi, pi, and still on t, because we haven't integrated over time. We only integrated over d3x. Now, the Hamiltonian depends on, in particular, on this variable here, the canonically conjugate momentum field. And that's the thing we want to get rid of. So we do a Legendre transform now, where we define a new variable that will replace the pi. And that will be a field that needs its own name. Let's call this thing beta. Okay, so beta is a Legendre transformed variable to pi. Because that's always how it works, right? We have a function of some variables, and then we Legendre transform with respect to one of them, and we get a new variable. And how is it defined? Well, if you want to do a Legendre transform of h with respect to pi, then the new variable is the h by the pi. Right? That's always how we do it for the Legendre transforms. We take the function in question and differentiate it with respect to the variable that we want to Legendre transform. And then we give this a name, we call it beta. And then we obtain the Lagrangian. Right? The Lagrangian is then the integral over the new variable beta times the old variable pi, but pi has to be expressed in terms of beta. Right? We are assuming here that for the Legendre transform to work, that once we have beta as a function of pi, we can also solve this to get pi as a function of beta. And then we express, so the Lagrangian is then the integral over the new variable beta times the old variable pi expressed in terms of beta minus the Hamiltonian, but the Hamiltonian contains pi, so pi has to be expressed in terms of beta. So what we obtain then is the Lagrangian, which is a function of phi and beta and t. Just straightforward Legendre transform. Now, we have more though. We have more than just a function that we Legendre transform. This function has a particular role to play, which is that it generates equations of motion. In particular, if you remember, the equations of motion in the Hamiltonian picture are these. Phi dot is dh by dpi, and pi dot is minus dh by dphi. This is a structure that has nothing to do with the Legendre transform. It's physics. That's why we have that. Let's call these two equations of motion, h1 and h2, for Hamiltonian framework, equation 1, Hamiltonian framework, equation of motion 2. Now, since we have these equations for the, in the Hamiltonian formulation, and since the Lagrangian formulation is equivalent, after all, we can do a Legendre transform of the Lagrangian, then we get back to h, right? Because it's idem potent, right? So we can, it's its own inverse, the Lagrangian. What we can do is just do another Legendre transform. So we take the derivative of L with respect to beta. We get the new variable. But the new variable is the old one. It's pi, right? So the L by d beta is pi again. And so the Legendre transform of L gives us back the h, as we proved in generality last time. Let's call the forward Legendre transformation t, and the backward Legendre transformation T inverse for later reference. So under this transformation, these equations transform into a new form. So we have these two equations here, and it turns out these are the Legendre transformed equations. And let's call them L1 and L2. The Legendre transform equations are that beta is phi dot, and that the L by d phi is d by dt, the L by d beta. The first one is easy to see here, right? Because beta is on one hand the h by d pi, but the h by d pi is also phi dot. So the equations of motion inform us that actually beta is phi dot. The Legendre transform wouldn't know that. It's agnostic about equations of motion. And then these two equations actually transform into that one, into the Euler-Lagrange equation. These are the Hamilton equations, and this is the Euler-Lagrange equation here. Let's see how that comes about. Let's prove that we can go from the Hamiltonian to the Lagrangian formulation. The first thing I already showed you, I mean, how do we prove L1? As we said, phi dot is the h by d pi by the equations of motion, but by the Legendre transform, the h by d pi is also beta. So therefore, we have phi dot is beta. We already discussed that. Now, let us prove the equation of motion L2 on the Lagrangian side. And here's how we can do this. We have d by dt. Remember which equation we have to prove? Here it is, right? We want to prove this equation here. So let's start with this, d by dt of dl by d beta, and then work out what that is. Okay, so d by dt of dl by d beta is what? Well, let us use the inverse of the Legendre transform. It tells us that dl by d beta is pi. Why is that? Well, because if we Legendre transform from L to H, then we have to differentiate with this L with respect to the variable beta, and that gives us the Legendre transform variable, which is pi. So by the inverse Legendre transform, I mean, we have that pi is the Legendre transform variable of beta, and beta is the Legendre transform variable of pi, and that's why this is actually pi. So we have that this is d by dt of pi. Now, pi dot, so this is pi dot, by the equation of by the Hamilton equations of motion, pi dot is minus the h by d phi. Okay, so here we just use the Legendre transform inverse, and here we are using now the second Hamilton equation, which says that pi dot is the h minus the h by d phi. And then let us express h in terms of the Lagrangian. So remember from the Legendre transform, this is a new old variable times new variable minus the old function, but expressed in terms of the relevant variables here. So h of phi and pi is given by beta of phi and pi times pi minus Lagrangian of phi and beta of phi and pi. Everything is expressed in terms of phi and pi here because h is a function of phi and pi. Now, we have to differentiate with respect to phi here, and we see we get here a term d beta by d phi. The only phi dependence in here is in beta. So we get a d beta by d phi, d beta by d phi times pi. And remember that the integration goes away. The integration goes away when we do functional differentiation. Because if you remember from the Newton-Leibniz limit, there was a Dirac delta in there. And that Dirac delta eats up that integral. It's something that will come up again later when we want to write down the action. It will be the reason why we need to introduce another t, time integration. Not just the space integration as in the Lagrangian, but we need to get another time integration to get to the action. Exactly so that we can do this trick. Okay, so dh by d, if we differentiate this piece by d phi, we just get this term here. Here, and then we have d by d phi of that. Now here we have two occurrences of phi, a direct occurrence and an indirect one through beta. So we have here a term which is dl by d phi, that's this one, as a minus because there's a minus and here's a minus. So it's dl by d phi. And then we get a term dl by d beta times d beta by d phi, chain rule, right? Now, dl by d beta by the Legendre transform is pi. So, because pi is the Legendre transform variable of beta. So this is pi d beta by d phi. Pi d beta by d phi. Here's a minus sign, here's a plus sign. These two terms go away, and we're just left with dl by d phi. And therefore, we have overall this is equal to dl by d phi, but that is the second order Lagrangian equation. This is the equation of motion in the Lagrangian formalism. So we see that they are equivalent. I invite you to do a little exercise and do it the other way around. Give yourself as an assumption that L1 and L2 are holding, and then use the Legendre transform to work out what H1 and H2 are. And in this way, you can just convince yourself that the equations of motion are the same. I mean, that H1 and H2 is equivalent to L1 and L2. So what result do we have so far? We did the Legendre transform to the Lagrangian formulation. The equations of motion, H1 and H2, The Hamilton equations of motion for phi dot and pi dot can now be recast in a new formulation, namely as L1 and L2. And they are that the Lejeune transform beta turns out to be simply phi dot, and the Euler-Lagrange equation here. Notice a subtle thing that is often mentioned only briefly or not mentioned at all in textbooks, which is that actually the variable in question here is beta after the Lejeune transform. And then by virtue of the equations of motion, beta is phi dot. Right? The Lejeune transform alone would not tell us that it's phi dot. It's another variable, it's beta. And then because of the equations of motion, it's phi dot. But what did we gain? These equations are not exactly looking covariant, right? Because there's a time derivative here, but where are the space derivatives? How could this thing possibly be covariant? And also that the time derivative here is singled out somehow, that's all not so nice. Let us see how we can restore the how we can show manifestly that there is really a beautiful covariance in all of this. So let us analyze these two equations, L1 and L2. Now, in our equations of motion, we have the expression dL by d phi. Now, what exactly does that mean? What does L depend on? L depends on phi, on the space derivatives of phi, and the time derivatives of phi. I made a mistake in what I just said. It doesn't depend on the time derivatives of phi. It depends on beta, right? And only because of the equations of motion do we, in hindsight, know that beta is actually phi dot. But in principle, L depends on phi and its space derivatives and another field variable, beta. Okay, so it is dependent on phi and its spatial derivatives. Let's see how that pans out. Well, because of the definition of d by d phi, we can see that this is the case. You see, what do I want to prove here? I want to prove that this is differentiating L not only with respect to phi, but also with respect to the space derivatives. That's important. Because if you look at this equation here, it looks as if this thing is not covariant. But now I'm making the claim that dL by d phi contains also derivatives with respect to the space derivatives of phi. This contains derivatives with respect to naked phis, but also with respect to phis which have a d by dxi in front of them. And what we will now do is separate them out. And then we will see that it's going to be a clean dL by d phi only with respect to phi, and terms dL by d phi, dL by d dx phi. And then here's the dt, and they combine nicely to give us something covariant. So, how does this come about? Let's see if it's true that dL by d phi contains also makes us differentiate also with respect to space differentiated versions of phi. So let's work it out. We have dL by d phi is by the original definition of what this functional derivative is. It's a limit, the Newton-Leibniz limit, epsilon going to 0, 1 over epsilon. And then here we have L at the shifted arguments minus L at the unshifted arguments. Shifted argument being the original field plus epsilon times Dirac delta of x minus x prime as we discussed. So for example, let's keep things simple. Let's work out this functional derivative for some arbitrary function where everything is pretty simple. So let's say we have a functional f of u. So this has nothing to do now with a Lagrangian. I just want to make a technical point here. that we see what that does. So we have f of u, f is a functional of u, and for example, it is the integral over dx of the sine of x, and then it doesn't depend on u in a naked form, but instead in a differentiated form. Right? And let's see whether when we differentiate f with respect to u, we get zero. Right? I mean, if the derivative with respect to u were to be considered a completely different function, then the derivative of f with respect to u should give zero. But it doesn't. Because according to that definition, according to the Newton-Leibniz definition, that's not what we will get. How do we see this? Well, we can just do an integration by parts. Then this derivative will act on the left. And the u is now naked. There is going to be, in principle, a boundary term, but we will, in the case of physical theories, assume that our functions u of x vanish at plus minus infinity, for example, because we expect them or we want them to be square integrable. So they'd have to vanish towards infinity, so we won't get boundary terms. So what that means is that we get that this integral is that integral. The derivative acting to the left produces a cosine. But because it's an integration by parts, we also pick up a minus. And now we have a naked u of x. And we can read off right away what the derivative of f with respect to u is. It is minus cosine x, right? Because this thing goes away as we differentiate with respect to u of x, and the integral goes away as always. You see, in general, we may have derivatives of phi in the Lagrangian, space derivatives of phi in the Lagrangian. Remember, this is a d3x here, just a spatial one, right? We may have space derivatives of phi, but in the Newton-Leibniz formula, those space derivatives will end up acting on that Dirac delta. So we do an integration by parts. Then they act on the other side, we pick up a minus sign and the derivative of whatever is on the left. And then we can integrate as usual because it's just a Dirac delta. That's exactly what we did in effect over here. So what we see is that the functional derivative of this functional that has a sine over here is actually the cosine, minus the cosine. Because we have to make this thing naked and by doing integration by parts. All right. So this tells us that L1 and L2 will contain non-trivial time and space derivatives. The time derivative we've already seen. And we don't expect any new time derivatives to come up because L doesn't have time derivatives of phi in it. It depends on beta for that. But there ought to be space derivatives. So is there a systematic way to evaluate the derivatives with respect to d phi by dxi? And yes, we can do that. Here's a little lemma. Consider any function on z, which is of the form integral. So z feeds on functions f and spits out a number. And how does it do it? Well, let's say that z of f is a polynomial of the space derivative of f. Then dz by df is minus d by dx of dz by d differentiating with respect to that derivative. So this derivative is to be viewed now as being executed using the Newton-Leibniz method, but considering the space derivative of f as being the independent function. Its argument is going to be shifted. For example, and you see, once we can do it for polynomials, we can do it for power series, and we can do it for well-behaved functions that have Taylor expansions, functional Taylor expansions. So for example, let's say z of f is the space derivative of f squared. Then what's the functional derivative of z with respect to f? And what is the, okay, so what's the functional derivative of z with respect to f? And let's see whether we get the right answer doing it both ways. See, we can calculate dz by df, or we can calculate dz by dxf and then minus d by dx on it. So let's work out both and see if, at least in this case, we can reproduce that this is true. So we will calculate both of these things. We start with the right-hand side. So in other words, we start with this. Let's evaluate that. Okay, so we do dz by dx here. All right. Okay, so what do we have? Dz by dxf. So now the independent variable is d by dxf. It's the derivative that we differentiate with respect to the derivative. So then we can read off immediately what the answer is. So this is the function with respect to which we are differentiating, and it's squared. So we get 2 times dxf of x, and the integral goes away as usual. So we have this. Now, we have to differentiate that once more and put a minus sign in front of it in order to get the right-hand side of the lemma. And what do we obtain then? Well, if we do minus d by dx of this, we get a minus 2 second space derivative of f. And the lemma claims that this is dz by df, if we evaluate it from first principles, where f is considered to be the independent variable here. So let's work out the left-hand side, dz by df, directly using Newton-Leibniz. Okay, so d by df of z. Now, what was z again? It's the space derivative squared of f. So it's the Newton-Leibniz limit, epsilon going to 0, 1 over epsilon, and then it's the argument shifted. And the function is obtained by squaring it, right? And that's then integrated over. And here is the unshifted original z of f. Now, what do we get? We get a term with epsilon squared here, right? Because, but this term ends up squared, but the epsilon squared term goes away because there's only one epsilon in the denominator, but 2 epsilons in the numerator, epsilon squared in the numerator, so that term goes away. Then there's also the leading term that doesn't depend on epsilon at all. But this thing is squared, but that's just cancelled with that term, as usual. And so we get then only twice the mixed term, where we multiply this with that. And the epsilon in that mixed term cancels that epsilon, that's the remaining term. And what is it? It's, you know, So the mixed term is where we have the derivative of f multiplying the derivative of the delta, right? Twice. So that's what we have here. We have twice derivative of f, derivative of the delta. Okay, and then we have what we anticipated earlier. We have the derivative acting on the Dirac delta. And in order to be able to evaluate the Dirac delta, we have to get rid of the derivative. So what we do is take an integration by parts. So if we do this, we get a minus sign. We drop boundary terms, assuming that f and its derivative vanish at infinity. And so then we have here the second derivative, multiplying the Dirac delta. We can carry out the integral, which will set x prime equal to x, and we end up with this, which matches the results that we got from the lemma. So we're not proving the lemma fully, but we proved it for the case of this particular monomial, where it's dx squared. And in principle, you can prove it now for all cases similarly. Okay, so, let me just show you the lemma again, because we will need it now. Where is it? Here it is. Okay, so when Z is a functional that contains the derivative of f, it's a functional of just the derivative of f, then this turns out to be what you get when you differentiate with respect to the derivative of f considered to be its own variable. But then you have to do minus d by dx on it, which comes about from the integration by parts that has to act on the Dirac delta. Okay, so here we are now. The Euler-Lagrange equation of the Lagrange of the, after Legendre transform in the Lagrangian formalism, we have this Euler-Lagrange equation, which we complained about because it's not covariant. At least it doesn't look covariant. We don't have a time derivative of phi in here, and we have this time derivative, but we don't have space derivatives. The whole thing is a little bit of a mess. So what do we get now? Well, now we can use the lemma and say the following. What we have to evaluate here, what we have to evaluate here on the left is dl by d phi. But remember that actually this contains not just a naked phi, but also space derivatives of phi, both of them. So when we spell it out, this is really dl by d phi, where we differentiate only with respect to the naked occurrences of phi, the undifferentiated occurrences of phi. But we also have to differentiate with respect to the occurrences of the space derivatives. So this total derivative with respect to phi is the derivative with respect to the direct occurrence of phi, the undifferentiated occurrence of phi, and then minus d by dx, according to the lemma, of the derivatives of dl by the space derivatives, where the space derivative here is considered to be its own variable. So now you see that the space derivatives occur in this picture here, because this derivative is a functional derivative with respect to all occurrences of phi, the naked ones and the differentiated ones. If we separate them out, which we can now do using the lemma, then we obtain that this expression is really a naked derivative and those space derivatives. So we can plug that in here, and then we get a naked derivative and we get the spatial derivatives too. And what we then obtain is that our equation of motion, the Euler-Lagrange equation, takes this form. It's dl by d phi, where this is now the derivative with respect to only the undifferentiated naked occurrences of phi, minus, and then here we have the space derivatives of dl differentiated with respect to the space-differentiated occurrences of phi, equal to the right-hand side, which we didn't change. Now, we also know that beta turns out, because of the equations of motion, to be phi dot. However, at this point, we may make a mistake, and you will find that in textbooks. Namely, we may think we could now write that dl by d phi, the derivative with respect to the naked occurrence of phi is equal to, and we just shift this stuff from above here to the right, and then we simply have the sum over d by dx mu dl by, and here we have the derivatives with respect to both the time derivative and the space derivatives of phi. So the temptation is to move this to the right, which we can certainly do. That part is correct. But then the temptation is to rewrite this as dl, not dl by d beta, but as dl by d phi dot. Right? That would be the temptation, but we cannot do it. Because the lemma required that there was an integral. Right? Because the Newton-Leibniz formula requires that, you know, you have a time derivative, you have a derivative on the Dirac delta. Well, yeah, but then you have to do an integration by parts in order to get the derivative away from the delta, and then everything worked out. But the Lagrangian doesn't have an integral over time. Can't do it. This really is just a derivative with respect to beta, not with respect to phi dot. It's a subtle point, but important, because what that means is that we cannot simply write what I wrote here in the thin black scripture, but instead, and I'm just writing here down what I just said in words, instead we have to introduce an extra time integration. We have to upgrade this. We have to go from the Lagrangian, where the time is not integrated, to the action function, where we integrate over time. So if we integrate not only over space, but also over time, then we get the so-called action function on. This is the action of the field evolution phi of x and t. And in terms of the action, we can now do what we wanted to do earlier for the Lagrangian. We can write this as the Lagrange equations now take the form that ds by d phi, where this is the differentiation with respect to just the naked occurrence of phi, no derivatives of phi, minus sum over space and time derivatives of ds by the space and time derivatives of phi. So these functional differentiations consider those derivatives as the independent variables. And we can do this now also for the time variable because we have an integral in the S. So these are the Euler-Lagrange equations of our classical field theory, of our Klein-Gordon theory. And in fact, the same is true for any other theory, like the Dirac theory or Maxwell equations and so on. They can all be put into this form. This is the action principle. This is the these are the Euler-Lagrange equations. If we spell out the difference between functionally differentiating only with respect to the naked occurrences of phi and functional differentiations with respect to differentiated versions of phi. Now, what if we don't? What if we say, in principle, we don't have to separate them out. Remember that we can also simply differentiate with respect to all occurrences of phi, differentiated or not. If we do this by using the lemma in reverse, then we get this. This is the same equation as that one, except that now the functional derivative is understood to be with respect to all occurrences of phi, whether they are differentiated with respect to time or space or not at all. With respect to all of them, this is the same as that. Usually, this is called the action principle, and that is called the Euler-Lagrange equations, but it's really the same thing. Here, you're just spelling out using the lemma the different terms that arise from differentiating the naked and the differentiated versions of phi. Okay. Okay, so the action principle, ds by d phi equal to zero, the last equation that we had on the board, is, if you spell it out, just by the Newton-Leibniz formula, this expression here, where we simply have to take the action functional and we shift its argument minus the action functional without a shift in the argument. And from that follows everything else, the Euler-Lagrange equations, you know, the lemma, all of these things follow from that. So, for example, then, let's look at the Klein-Gordon action. The Klein-Gordon action was this one, 1/2 time derivative squared minus the space derivative squared minus m squared phi, all integrated over d4x. You can obtain that by starting with the Klein-Gordon Hamiltonian, doing the Legendre transform, getting to the beta, and replacing the beta by the d by d phi, d by dt of phi by the phi dot, because we know that from the Euler-Lagrange equation, from the equations of motion. And here we go. So that's the action of the Klein-Gordon field. And once we have that, then we can derive the equations of motion in the Lagrangian formalism, or also called the action formalism. The Lagrangian formalism and the action formalism are the same thing, just two different words. It's just whether you emphasize the L or the S, S being the integral over L, over time. So now we can calculate what the equations of motion are coming from the action. We can do that by just taking ds by d phi equal to zero. Or we can take the longer version of the Euler-Lagrange equations. But in any case, in a few steps that you please check on your own, you can verify that these, you get here the Klein-Gordon equation again, where the box operator is d naught squared minus Laplacian. So what we have here is that the action is the integral of the Lagrangian over time, but the Lagrangian is itself an integral over d3x. And if we write out those four integrations over space and time, then the thing that we have in here is called the Lagrangian density. If we integrate L only over space, then we get the Lagrangian with the Latin L. And if we integrate it also over time, then we get the action. Now, what you often find in the literature is things like this, where they say the equations of motion are dL by d phi equal to this. Now keep in mind, not right, it's S that has to be there, right? Because otherwise it makes no sense. You have to do these functional differentiations, and then you have to have an integral against which you can do the integration by parts. So strictly speaking, it's not, the Euler-Lagrange equations are not expressed in terms of the Lagrangian densities, but in terms of the action S. All right, so now we have arrived at a form for the equations of motion that is manifestly covariant, or can be manifestly covariant. We haven't quite figured it out yet. So now the next step after we arrived fully in the Lagrangian formalism is to establish the covariance of it and to generalize it from Minkowski space to curved space, and then see what options are there for curved spaces. How curved can space-time be? And so on. I'll give a very quick crash course on that. Since a lot of derivatives of fields will occur, the notation is often used that Einstein introduced, which is that if you differentiate with respect to space or time, then you just use a comma to indicate that. I assume you've all seen this before. Also, we will adopt Einstein's convention that twice occurring indices are being summed over. Right, now, in special relativity, remember the metric tensor takes this form, and we will give it a name, we will call it eta mu nu in the case of special relativity. Now using these definitions, the definition with the summing over twice occurring indices, the comma denoting space and time derivatives, and the eta being the eta or the g mu nu being the metric, we can write our action now in this form. So the action functional of phi is 1/2, and then the metric contracted with the space-time derivatives minus m squared phi squared. Notice a little subtlety that will come up some more in this course, which is that the metric tensor arises here with two upper indices rather than two lower indices. Whereas here I wrote it as it's usually first introduced with lower indices. The metric tensor with upper indices is the inverse matrix. By definition, it's just the inverse matrix. Now, what's the inverse matrix of this one? Itself, right? So in that case, it's trivial, but for general relativity, it will make a difference. So let's keep that in mind. So the Euler Lagrange equations now take this form, ds by d phi, where the action depends on phi and on the space and time derivatives. So it depends on the phi comma mu, mu running from 0 to 3. It's given by d by dx mu, ds by d, and then the space and time derivatives, right? So here we only functional differentiating with respect to the naked phis, and here with respect to the differentiated phis. And then that equation becomes what? Well, let's see. We functionally differentiate with respect to the naked occurrences of phi. Well, what are the naked occurrences of phi in here? This one, right? That's the only undifferentiated occurrence of phi. And then here we have the differentiated occurrences of phi. So if we differentiate this with respect to phi, here we go, then we get a minus 2m squared phi. And the integral goes away. So we have just minus m squared phi. And then this term here gives us something from here. Again, we get a factor of 2 because we get one term from here and one term from differentiating that one by the product rule. But we have a factor of 1/2 in front, so that goes away. And so what we obtain is that this is d by d mu. And then the g mu phi comma nu. Right. So we carry this forward. This d mu is this one. And then here we just have the functional differentiations of s with respect to the derivatives of phi. So it picks up on this and on that term. And that equation is, again, the Klein-Gordon equation. Here we have a space and time derivatives, and here we have another space and time derivatives. In this case here, the derivatives act trivially on the metric because it's constant. It's just the metric that we had up there, minus 1, 1, 1, 1. Okay, so we recover here the Klein-Gordon equation again. So where have we arrived here? We've completed now the step one. We started with the Klein-Gordon field in terms of phi and pi, and now we've arrived at the Klein-Gordon field in terms of phi and its space and time derivatives. Now we are about ready to introduce curvature, because it's now in a beautifully covariant framework. But how can we allow for curvature of space-time? Here's the strategy that we will adopt for this. It's basically a quick rederivation of general relativity. The strategy is this. Within special relativity, so while we are staying in Minkowski space, we allow not just inertial, rectangular, Cartesian coordinate systems, but we allow arbitrary coordinate systems. So first, let's make sure that we get the laws of nature, here the action principle, in a formulation that is exactly the same, no matter whether you are in a Cartesian coordinate system or in some crazy coordinate system like in a carnival where you're on a merry-go-round or something where the coordinate system rotates and is polar and whatever. So the first step is going to be to reformulate the theory such that any coordinate system goes. And then it will be a relatively small step to allow also curvature, as you will see. As you can imagine, because once you allow arbitrary coordinate system, including accelerated ones, then kind of by the equivalence principle, you would expect that, maybe that allows me to introduce curvature too, and we will see how that works. Okay, so reformulating everything such that it has the same exact functional form in any arbitrary coordinate system. So the equations are supposed to look exactly the same in all coordinate systems. Let us look at our Klein-Gordon action and see if it already perhaps has this property. So this is our Klein-Gordon action. What happens if we change to arbitrary other coordinates? So this was in Minkowski space with Cartesian coordinates, space and time. What if we go to other coordinates, like the rest frame of somebody who's sitting on a carousel that goes around? Okay, so then we have that the coordinates x mu go into coordinates x tilde mu, which are functions of the x. How much freedom do we have in this? Four functions, right? Because the x mu, the new coordinates, are functions of the old coordinates, the x. So there are four functions that we have free to specify, namely x naught of x, x naught tilde of x, x1 tilde of x, x2 tilde of x, x3 tilde of x. Four functions, let's keep that in mind. That's how many degrees of freedom we have in choosing a new coordinate system. Then what happens? Well, the field is a scalar field in this case, so it transforms pretty easily under this change of coordinates. Phi of x goes into phi tilde of x tilde, which takes the same value because it's a scalar. So it's still the same number phi of x tilde, right? So the new function of the new variable is simply the old function of the old variable expressed in terms of the new variable. That's how scalar fields work. Now, what about the derivative? What about the derivative of the field phi? Well, it goes into the derivative with respect to the new variable of the field with respect to the new variable. Let's see what that is. Well, we know that phi tilde of x tilde is phi of x tilde. So let's put it in here. So we carry forward this over here by doing this. We write phi tilde of x tilde as phi of x tilde. And then the derivative with respect to x tilde by the chain rule is the derivative with respect to x, and then the derivative of x with respect to x tilde. Right? So that is this. But now you see, this was the original derivative. Now we picked up an extra term from the chain rule. So while the fields didn't change, the derivatives of the field did change under the change of coordinates. Therefore, we can now do, I mean, we have to expect now that if we change variables in the action, if we change coordinates in the action will change. Because the action depends not only on phi, which is invariant, it also depends on the derivatives of phi, and they pick up extra terms. But remember that the action also contained the metric. If we now legislate that the metric transforms in a suitable way, then we can keep the action the same. Let's do this. We transform g tilde into a g, the original metric, into the metric in the new coordinates, g tilde, by definition, in this way, that it's the old metric multiplied with these matrices. Remember, double occurring indices are being summed over. So we have here this metric, and then we put these two matrices there. This has a particular purpose, because it means that this term that occurs in the action is actually a scalar. It doesn't change. How do we see that? Well, this term occurs in the action, remember. Now, under change of coordinates, we just calculated how this transforms, and then we legislated that we transform the metric in this way. Then what happens? Well, then we have in the new coordinate system everything with tildes, g tilde and the tilde derivatives, and we wish this to be the same number as the same thing calculated without the tildes. And we will get this because these terms are the old terms multiplied with these two matrices, right? The chain rule factors that we calculated. But the metric by legislation transforms like this. That's our definition. And if we now look at what we have is that this matrix and that matrix are undone by those two matrices. Because whenever you have a dx tilde by dx, dx by dx tilde, and you sum over the corresponding indices. Let's see, where do we do that, for example? Yeah, for example, here we have d by dx tilde mu, and here we have dx tilde mu, all right? So that means, if you look at those two, that we have d by dx rho, d by dx tilde, d by dx tilde, dx alpha, which means that those two matrices multiplied, I mean, if you sum over the mu, you get a Kronecker delta of rho and alpha, right? Because you simply get dx rho by dx alpha. It's a Kronecker delta. And the same with those two guys, because that index matches that. That gives us a Kronecker delta in epsilon and beta. And therefore, we just get two Kronecker deltas here, and this and that, so we get the exact same expression. Which means what we have here achieved is that we found a formulation of the action, of this particular interesting term in the action, the important term in the action, a formulation such that you can say this is how the action is being calculated, and you don't have to specify in what coordinate system. You will get the exact same number for that expression in whatever coordinate system you calculated. You just have to keep in mind that as you move from coordinate system to coordinate system, you're not just changing these derivatives by chain rule factors. No, you also have to transform the metric according to this. All right, so this is just this business with the Kronecker deltas. So what we say here is, the terminology is that G mu nu with the upper indices is a contravariant tensor of rank 2. Contravariant because the indices are upper, and rank 2 because there are two of them. The metric is ordinarily, as I said, introduced with lower indices, so it's a covariant rank 2 tensor, but its inverse is a contravariant rank 2 tensor. And remember that the upper and the lower index ones are by definition inverses to each other. So you just get the Kronecker delta then, if you contract them. Okay, and this is how the lower index metric transforms under changes of coordinates. That's no longer free to us. We were free to choose the transformation law once. But once we have that for the metric with the upper indices, then because the metric with the lower indices is the inverse of that one, that determines completely what the transformation rule must be for the inverse matrix. So the metric with the lower indices is called a covariant rank 2 tensor. So is the action now coordinate system independent? Not quite yet. And why would that be? We have achieved that every term in the action is invariant under changes of coordinates. Every term like m squared phi squared is of course invariant, because m is invariant and phi is a scalar. We also made sure that the term with phi, D'Alembertian phi is invariant, because that just involves derivatives and the metric, and that's the term we just took care of. So how come that I'm cautioning here that the action is still not covariant? Since every integrand is covariant, why is the integral not covariant? Do you know why? Any guesses? It's the integration measure that's not covariant. Okay, let's see how that happens. So as we change coordinates from x to x tilde, the integral measure, so the d4x, changes by Jacobian factor. Remember, if you do a change of coordinates in a multidimensional integral, then the integration measure produces this factor here of a determinant of dx by dx tilde. It's always the case, nothing to do with general relativity. Just if you change coordinates, if you change variables in a multidimensional integral, that's what happens. You pick up this measure factor here. You can view it this way, that the d4x is like a little cube in four-dimensional space. If you regulate it, before you take the limit of the length sizes being arbitrarily small. Now, if you change coordinates, you're deforming that cube. You're making that bigger or smaller, and you're turning it, and you're squeezing it, and it becomes a parallelogram, and so on. And that factor here, that this determinant, tells you by what ratio that volume element changes. For example, you could change coordinates such that everything gets stretched out numerically or squeezed. But the integral itself, of course, must be the same. So in order to get the same after the change of variables, you have to compensate for that. And that's this compensation factor here. So now, how can we change the action such that the action is invariant under changes of coordinate? The solution is this. We modify the action to put in this particular term here. You see, we're doing here an introduction to general relativity in like 10 minutes. So we put this term in here, the square root of minus the determinant of the metric. In Minkowski space, that's cheap, because that's just one. We can just add that, right? Because the metric is minus 1, 1, 1, 1. The determinant of that is minus 1. Minus of that is plus 1. The square root of 1 is 1. So in Minkowski space, the Cartesian coordinates, we haven't done anything. But now we want to do Minkowski space in non-Cartesian coordinates, where the metric could have some wild form. Because remember, it transforms with these two matrices. And if your change of coordinates is wild, then these matrices will be full of non-zero entries, and the metric will take some non-trivial form. It will no longer look like minus 1, 1, 1, 1. No, it will be some complicated 4 by 4 matrix. Symmetric still, but complicated 4 by 4 matrix. The determinant may not be 1 or minus 1 anymore, and so the whole thing might be much more complicated, and that is important. It's important that we keep that factor. So first of all, I mean, why this factor? When the metric is this one, like in Minkowski space on in Cartesian coordinates, then this factor is just 1, so we haven't done any damage. But if we change coordinates, then it can be shown that the square root of the absolute value of the determinant of the metric goes into the square root of the absolute value of the determinant of the metric multiplied with this determinant. And you may wonder, multiplied with the original square root of the absolute value of the determinant of the metric. And you may wonder, have I not seen this factor before? Almost. When you change variables from one coordinate system to another coordinate system in an integral, then yes, you get a determinant factor. But it is the opposite one. It's the one where you have the x's up there and the x tilde is down there. And that's important, because that means that these two factors are the inverse of each other. So we have that the measure of the integral transforms with the inverse of this factor, and then we have this factor in here, and that transforms positively with this factor, so the two factors just cancel each other out. So what we have is that in special relativity, if you choose arbitrary coordinate systems, then the action, a functional of phi, goes into a new functional of phi, phi tilde then, which is expressed in terms of the L tilde, and this factor of square root of absolute value of the determinant of G. This thing, we made sure, is invariant, doesn't change at all. This thing picks up a determinant factor, and that thing picks up the inverse of that determinant factor. Let's see how that comes about. That becomes this. Remember, L tilde is L, numerically the same thing. And then we pick up one determinant factor from the transformation property of that measure factor, and one determinant factor because we change coordinates. And then the product of two determinants is the determinant of the product of the two matrices. But you see here what's going on? Oh, I made a mistake. You see, this is x tilde, and this is x, and this is x, this is x tilde. So therefore, I should have here x tilde and here x and x tilde. I have to fix this. And then you get a chain rule term. So you get the dx by the x tilde by dx. And then it becomes just a derivative of that with respect to this. And that's the same variable. So you get a Kronecker delta here. So you just get the determinant of the identity matrix. And that is one. And therefore, the action stays the same. Yeah, actually, the next line says so, right? The determinant of the Kronecker delta of the identity matrix, which is 1, and so therefore it's the action. Therefore, the action calculated in another coordinate system gives you the exact same number as the original value of the action. So what did we have to do? We had to make sure we know how to transform the metric. And we had to introduce this extra term here. But once we do this, we achieved that the laws of nature, classical laws of nature, the S of phi, the action principle, the S by the phi is equal to 0, that these laws of nature take the exact same form, independent of the coordinate system. It's a major achievement. Because previously, you always had to say, yeah, okay, but you got to work in the canonical, in the Cartesian coordinate system. Think of quantum mechanics, for example. It doesn't have that. Quantum mechanics, the x and the p variables, have the canonical commutation relations. But that's because we are working in Cartesian coordinates. Imagine you work in polar coordinates. You think that the radial variable and the theta and the phi variables have the same commutation relations as the x's and the p's? They don't. It's much more complicated. So what we've achieved here is that the laws of nature take completely the same form in whichever coordinate system we choose. It's just that in some coordinate systems they might look simpler, in some they may look more complicated. So in particular, since we're still working with Minkowski space, we know there are some coordinate systems in which the metric looks very simple. It's just minus 1, 1, 1, 1. There are coordinate systems, they all differ just by Lorentz transformations, right? So there are coordinate systems in which the metric is simply minus 1, 1, 1, 1. And not only that, then also this square root of the absolute value of the determinant of G is also just 1 and things simplify. But in principle, that's just, it's not fundamental. It just means, yeah, it's simpler. But the form is the same. The action is always the same if we write it like this. The Lagrangian and then this square root factor and so on. This action is all you need to know. You don't need to specify what coordinate system you work with. Okay, so now, this means we have a formulation that, for example, doesn't care about accelerations, right? So could it be that we are close to allowing curvature now? Yes, we can do it, and it's quite subtle. So remember that the trivial metric of Minkowski space in Cartesian coordinates is this. Okay, now we choose the convention 1, minus 1, minus 1, 1. It used to be that the East Coast used a different notation from the West Coast. It's just a notation. I think now it's just mixed, and it would be good if we just stick to one. I may not always stick to the same. Okay, the point is that in Cartesian coordinates, in Minkowski space, the metric takes the simple form. But then if you choose some funny coordinate system, spherical coordinates of a carousel that you're moving on, and then maybe the carousel is on a truck, which is on a ship, and so the whole thing is, you know, rotating, moving, and wobbling. You can go into the rest frame of such an observer. That's fine. And the metric will be funny, right? It will be lots of non-zero, all the entries will be non-zero in here, complicated. Not easy to solve equations of motion in this coordinate system, but so what? As a matter of principle, the same equations of motions are there, just with different coefficients, but the form is the same. Now, because the metric tensor transforms under changes of coordinates by multiplying with two matrices which are identical, each index contracts with the same matrix, change of coordinates matrix, the metric tensor is always symmetric. In every coordinate system, we have g mu nu is g nu mu, right? It's always symmetric. So no matter how wild the coordinate system is that you choose, this matrix is always a symmetric matrix. But now let me ask you the reverse question. Imagine, I mean, the forward question is this. If I give you the metric like this, and then tell you change into another coordinate system, you can now calculate how it would look like in another coordinate system. Just calculate this matrix dx tilde mu by dx nu, and then multiply it onto the metric, you get the metric in the new coordinate system. And then you will get something funny looking like this. But the reverse problem is this. Imagine I give you a funny looking metric, and then ask you to go back. I tell you, okay, so that's my coordinate system. Transform back into Cartesian coordinates. In Minkowski space, you can always do it. It may be hard to do, but in Minkowski space, you can always do it. Because it's Minkowski space, you can choose Cartesian coordinates. It may not be easy to find them, but they exist. But could it be that there are some metric tensors for which there simply doesn't exist a coordinate transformation such that it takes this form? Could that be? What do you think? Could it be? Does every symmetric 4x4 matrix arise from this by coordinate transformation?
It would depend on whether you want it locally.
Very good, very good. The answer is no, except locally. So the answer is that if you write down some generic metric g mu nu of x with, you know, it's a symmetric tensor, a symmetric matrix, but you just choose arbitrary functions in here, and then down here the same ones. It's just functions that you pull out of a hat, then no, there is not going to be a coordinate transformation that turns it into this. Not everywhere. But there's always a coordinate transformation such that at a particular location, it becomes this. And you can choose that location. So you can say, at this particular event in space-time, I want the metric to look like this. Yes, it's guaranteed that there is going to be a transformation that gets you there, but only there. At the neighboring points, it's not going to be true. Is that really true, what I just said? Almost true. You see, there are metrics where you can't do this, where the best you can do is get it into the form of a metric that is of the form 1, 1, 1, 1, 1. Or 1, 1, minus 1, minus 1. You can't actually change the signature. So among all the symmetric tensors, you can put them into different categories. The ones that can locally be put into this form, and the ones that can be locally put into the form of 1, 1, 1, 1, 1. Which would be Euclidean metrics, they wouldn't be space-times. They would be just space, four-dimensional space, right? And then there could be those with two times, where you have like 1, 1, minus 1, minus 1. But within that class of metrics, which locally can always be transformed into that form, so there exists a coordinate system for any choice of event such that at that event, the metric takes this form, but nowhere else. So that subclass of metrics is what we want to consider, right? And in that subclass, almost all the metrics do not have a coordinate transformation that will turn them into this everywhere. So what then is the interpretation of those space-times which for which there always exists for every event a coordinate transformation such that at this event the metric takes this form, but not generally. What is the interpretation of these metrics? The interpretation is that Pythagoras doesn't hold. Pythagoras doesn't hold because that means Pythagoras holds. Right? If you can find a coordinate system in which this is the metric, then Pythagoras holds, actually the space-time generalization of it. If you could transform into a coordinate system such that everywhere the metric is 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, then strictly speaking, Pythagoras would hold. Because this is the metric according to which you calculate distances. So that means that you are violating Pythagoras. And we know how Pythagoras can be violated by curvature. Okay, so it turns out that keeping the action as it is, but allowing the metric to be of the kind that only locally can be transformed into this form, is the introduction of curvature into space-time. Okay, so remember this is how the metric transforms in the case of Minkowski space. We have here eta, which is just minus one, whichever signature it is. And here we have the two change of coordinates matrices. And then this is always symmetric. Okay, so G mu is always a symmetric tensor. And on these slides, I just have what I said in words already. Okay, so here we said, that do all the metrics arise in this way from the Minkowski space metric? And the answer is no. There are many other metrics, and they then describe curved space times. So what we see then is that the set of metric tensors, g mu nu of x, breaks up into equivalence classes of metric tensors, where you say that one metric is equivalent to another if there's a coordinate transformation that turns the one into the other. And then, if that's the case, if two metrics are connected by a change of coordinates, well, then we're describing the same space-time. And the same space-time, it's just a matter of changing coordinates. But some metric tensors, g mu nu of x, some pairs of g mu nu of x, are simply not connected by changes of coordinates. They describe different space-times. So therefore, a space-time, a choice of space-time, can be described as an equivalence class of metric tensors. You see, why do they form an equivalence class? Remember that a set of whatever elements forms a so-called equivalence class if it's true that if A and B are equivalent and B and C are equivalent, then A and C are equivalent. So clearly we have that here. Because if there is a change of coordinates that gets you from the first metric to the second metric, and there is a change of coordinates that gets you from the second to the third, then clearly there's a change of coordinates that gets you from the first to the third. So therefore, metrics that are related by changes of coordinates, by differentiable maps from R4 into R4, therefore, changes of coordinates are of that type, that are, we say, related by diffeomorphisms. So all those metrics that are related by diffeomorphisms belong to one equivalence class. And each equivalence class describes a space-time. We have to be a little bit careful here. I'm simplifying things a little bit because some space-times, just like some spaces, need more than one map to describe it. For example, like the surface of a sphere. Right? Surface of a ball, a sphere, need more than one map to actually, more than one coordinate system to describe the whole thing. Or you have a torus or something like that. okay, but for the universe as we know it, probably one coordinate system actually suffices. Okay, so space-times are equivalence classes, of metrics that differ only by change of coordinates. And each one of these equivalence classes is called, mathematically speaking, a Riemannian structure or a Lorentzian structure. See, if the signature of that equivalence class is 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, then we are not describing a space-time. We are describing a space, a curved space, because there's no time coordinate in there. And then we call what we're describing here a Riemannian structure. And if the signature is minus 1, 1, 1, 1, so if the equivalence class has members in it in which the metric takes the form minus 1, 1, 1, 1, then we say that this equivalence class describes a space-time. And it's then called a Lorentzian structure. This is important to keep in mind if you're interested in quantum gravity, because the path integral quantization method says we should always sum over all or integrate over all possible values of the degrees of freedom, over all possible, of all possibilities. It's a sum over histories, right? Which means for quantum gravity, it probably means that we have to sum over all Lorentzian structures. Just like summing over all fields, summing over all paths. For space-time, it probably means summing over all Lorentzian structures. But Lorentzian structures are harder to describe than fields, because a Lorentzian structure is an equivalence class of metrics. And it's very difficult if you are given two metrics to find out whether or not they're equivalent, whether or not there exists a diffeomorphism that maps the one into the other. Very difficult to establish that. So that means it's very hard to practically work with those equivalence classes, which is what one of the main reasons why quantum gravity is hard. We can write down which sum over all equivalence classes, but how do you do that in practice? Now let's do a simple estimate as the last thing that we do today. How many Lorentzian or Riemannian structures are there? How many degrees of freedom are there in curvature? So how many independent degrees of freedom describe a space-time fully? Mathematically speaking, it's the following problem. If I give you a metric, then I'm giving you a space-time. How much freedom do I have when I give you a metric? Well, it would seem I have to fill a 4x4 matrix with functions. Every matrix element is a function. Now, true, I don't get to choose all those functions freely because it's a symmetric matrix. But other than that, I can completely freely choose, right? How many entries are they? The free matrix elements of the metric then? Well, it's n times n plus 1/2. Right? Well, we get to that in a moment, exactly why that is. But in any case, so many degrees of freedom. So it would seem that this is how much freedom I have in choosing metrics, and therefore, this is how much freedom I have in choosing space-times. Not so. Because somebody else might give you another metric, but it's in the same equivalence class. There's a diffeomorphism. Right? So then that's not actually a different space-time. It's the same Lorentzian structure. You're describing the same space-time. It just looks very different as a matrix-valued function. So therefore, we have to mod out. We have to say, how many degrees of freedom do I really have? Taking into account that they are modular changing coordinate systems. So let's see how many degrees of freedom do I really have to specify a space-time. Let's count them. So, in n dimensions, the metric has n squared components, right? It's an n by n matrix, so it has n squared components. Can I choose them freely? No, because it's a symmetric matrix. That means it has n times n plus 1/2 independent matrix elements. Why that? Well, it's the number of independent entries in a symmetric matrix. Now, why is that? forget about the diagonal. The diagonal is easy. It has n elements, right? I get to choose the n elements on the diagonal clearly, right? But then, apart from the diagonal, how many elements are there? Apart from the diagonal. Well, that's going to be n times n minus 1, right? Because we are taking n away. So it's n times n minus 1. So that's the upper diagonal, the upper triangle, and the lower triangle, which are the same. So it's n times n minus 1 half. So I get the diagonal, n of them, plus n times n minus 1 half. So I get n times n minus 1 half plus n. So I get n times n plus minus 1 half plus n. This is the upper triangular, let's say. And then this is the diagonal. And that is n times n plus 1 half. All right? Okay, so we get n times n plus 1 half matrix elements to choose. These are the functions we can choose. So many. But modular changes of coordinates. For example, I could insist that in the metric, let's say, you know, there are four entries here and so on. It's a 4x4 matrix. I could insist that this entry here is a 3. How do I do that? Well, I choose my coordinates in such a way that these two matrices that I have that come from the change of variables conspire to make this 3. Why can I do this? I can do this because in the change of coordinates, I have four functions free. It's like a fairy that tells you you have 3 wishes, right? So similarly here, you have 4. Because you get to choose x mu tilde as a function of the x's. So there's x naught, x2, x3 tilde that you get to choose. 4 arbitrary functions. And since you have 4 arbitrary functions free to choose, you can arrange these things to fulfill 4 wishes of what you want in this matrix to happen. For example, this is 3 and that one is 7 and 4 all points. Can probably do this. So the number of actual degrees of freedom is the number that we just calculated minus the number of free wishes we have that are just, you know, from the changes of coordinates. So that's minus n then, right? So we take this minus n because n is 4, right? It's 4x4 matrix, 4 space plus time dimensions. Space plus time dimensions is 4. So we get n times n plus 1 half minus n, which is n times n minus 1 half. Okay, so this is the number we get. And how much is that? Well, let's say our space-time had only 2 dimensions. Well, if it has 2 dimensions, then what is it? Then we have 2 times 1 divided by 2 is 1. It's a very important result. It means that if you have a 2-dimensional surface, the curvature is described by 1 number. And do you know what that number is? It's the radius of the sphere that is touching the point there. It's the Gaussian curvature of 1 over the radius. Right? It's a Gaussian curvature. Right? So you have some surface, and then you put the sphere there, which approximates the local curvature the best there, right? And that radius is the curvature radius. And for 2-dimensional surfaces, and in generalization for space-time, even though there it's not actually a real number, because curvature between space and time is actually expansion or shrinkage, rather than what we geometrically think of as curvature. The point is that for 2-dimensional surfaces, curvature is a scalar. It's just 1 number, right? So at every point of the surface, the curvature is described by 1 number, Gaussian curvature. Now, how about space-time? Four-dimensional. Three space plus one time dimension. Four-dimensional. N is equal to 4. Then what? Then we have 4 times 3 is 12 divided by 2 is 6. So in our universe, it seems we have 6 degrees of freedom in the metric. So there's 6 degrees of freedom in specifying a metric in space-time, where we modeled out by the diffeomorphism group already, by the changes of coordinates group, 6. How do we understand that? You can understand it in terms of Gaussian curvature again. Because imagine slicing your space-time. You see, look at a coordinate system. You have an xy plane. You have an xz plane. You have a yz plane. And you have an xt plane, a yt plane, and a zt plane. 6 of them, right? And so at any point in space-time, you can look at any one of these 6 planes and ask, how much is it curved? Right? So you can slice to every point in space-time, you can do 6 orthogonal planes and ask, how much is that curved? How much is space curved in that plane direction? And you get a Gaussian curvature for that because it's just two-dimensional. So you get 6 Gaussian curvatures there. They're called the sectional curvatures. And in the case of a Riemannian space-time, they turn out to be the eigenvalues of the Riemann curvature tensor if you view it as a map from two-index space to two-index space. All right, so there's some intuition for this, but you can also imagine how this number grows quadratically, right? If space-time had many more dimensions, curvature would be way more complicated because it grows quadratically, the number of degrees of freedom that space-time has. All right, that's as far as we get today. Okay, see you on Tuesday. Any questions? I often forget to ask questions. But you know, you can always ask questions even in class. I like it. It will just take longer.
I can have one question.
Yeah.
Doesn't this, like these 6 numbers of curvature, help in getting to talk about the possible metrics that we can have?
I wish they would, but it's very hard because they're not canonical, right? Okay, so in the case of Riemannian space-times, you might make some headway there. And the reason is that even though what you choose to be the xy plane and what you choose to be the xz plane and so at any point is arbitrary, it turns out that these curvatures occur as the eigenvalues of the Riemann curvature tensor if you give it indices A, B, C, D like this. Then you have anti-symmetry here, you have anti-symmetry there, and the whole thing can be viewed as a map from the space of anti-symmetric contravariant two tensors into the space of anti-symmetric covariant two tensors. And this map is self-adjoint, so you can diagonalize it. And you find that it has 6 eigenvalues, which are the 6 Gaussian curvatures, the 6 sectional curvatures. However, in space-time, this operator is not self-adjoint. And the reason is that the metric has indefinite signature. There's a minus 1, 1, 1, 1 in there. And that means that the inner product in that space where this thing acts is non-trivial. It's not just the 1, 1, 1, 1, 1 inner product. And that means that this operator isn't self-adjoint. And that means we can't just diagonalize it. It's not self-adjoint, it's not even a normal operator, which means it doesn't have a diagonalization in terms of orthogonal vectors and real eigenvalues. And so, yeah, that's unfortunate. I think a lot of things would be much easier if we had only space dimensions. Except nothing would ever happen because there's no time. Yeah. Yeah, so the sectional curvatures, in principle, you can define them, but they're either not canonical, or if you try to make the canonical, you stick to the Riemannian case. Right. Okay. Have a nice weekend.